Our next speaker was supposed to be Dr. Gabisa Ajeta, a World Food Prize recipient. Just very recently, Dr. Ajeta informed us that he wasn't going to be able to come to the meetings this year, but he gave us strict instructions to you, the whole audience right now, to stay and start our discussion about what we've heard so far, and also bringing in also a crops perspective. He was he's a crop breeder, and for those of you in the audience who are crop breeders and working from the crops perspective or working on projects that are linked to breeders, we're going to head into our, so this now until 9:15, when Jim Jones is going to give his talk, we're going to, this is our first chance for a real discussion through with the whole audience. So actually, I see that Jerry Nelson has come into the audience, and he is the leader of a project called Global Futures, which is linking crop breeders to crop modelers. So, Jerry, do you think you could just share with the audience here what's up with that project? What are there some emerging insights that have started coming already from working with the breeders? And that will then launch us into our discussion on what we've heard today about the soil solutions to climate change, agronomy perspective, and then at 9:15 we're going to hear about AgMIP with Jim Jones. So, Jerry, and please introduce yourself. Yes, you are, but you can handle. I know you can handle it.
Come to the microphone.
Yeah, come. Why don't you come on up? Great. So Jerry Nelson is an economist, currently at IFBRI, but for many years at
University of Illinois.
And just by way of full disclaimer, in the ag econ department, so I'm an economist. And I should say that Jim actually is probably better placed to answer some of the questions about interactions between breeders and ag economists. Because he is in the trenches in this project, working with the breeders at the CGIAR centers and the ag economists to try to bring these two groups together to do a better job. So the goal of the project fundamentally is a simple one. It's if somebody came to the CGIAR, and you could probably say the same thing for the land grant system in the United States, with an extra $50 million or $100 million or $10 million, what's the best way to spend that money? Where do you get the biggest return on investment in spending that money? And we in the CGIAR did not have a good answer to that question, and I think, frankly, the land grant system doesn't really have a good answer to that question either. So what happened in the CGIAR, roughly speaking, and with a little bit of exaggeration, was that the money got handed out in smoke-filled rooms. There was a process in place to do it, but, you know, in some sense, that's how it happened in the land grant system as well. So we wanted to say, all right, you breeders, tell us what you can actually think you can do technically. But don't just give us we think we can raise yields by 0.5% a year if you give us some more money. We want you to tell us what you're going to actually do to the crop to change the way the biology works. And then we will take Jim's or somebody else's crop model and actually create a virtual version of what the breeders think they can do, grow it around the world in different agroclimatic zones to see how it performs, and then plug those results into an economic model which says what's that worth in those different places. So with an assessment of the costs of how much it would take to do this and the benefits, we can then calculate a rate of return on investment for that additional $10 million. Now, of course, that's a non-trivial challenge, both on the economic side, but also on the breeding side and on the modeling side. So we're in the early stages of actually implementing this in a serious, systematic way, but we're going to, in January, attempt to go all the way from the beginning, which is to say, here's a new potential improved variety, here's how long it'll take it to put in place, here's what it'll cost to do it, and then here are the returns on the other end. So that's the shorthand.
May I ask you another question?
You may.
We, agriculture is a
panoply and a very heterogeneous array, including very efficient producers and responsible ones who will answer the need to intensify production and reduce emissions.
And you want to use others. Just so people can hear you.
I'm pointing out that world agriculture is very heterogeneous and it includes producers that are very efficient and that are very conscious of the need to intensify production and to reduce emissions. And it also includes many, many who practice agriculture that is indeed a part of the problem and growing worse. Now, from the point of view of an economist, how can we put in place policies on the national level and on the international level that would encourage and reward those farmers who produce efficiently and minimize the emissions that are of concern? And how do we penalize or prevent those who are inefficient from continuing to spew out these gases that are so harmful in the long run? Is there some mechanism for doing that, nationally or internationally or both?
Well, the short answer is yes and no, right?
More, yes or no?
Both. You know, Roosevelt, you know, once said, please send me only one-handed economists because I'm always getting the economists say on the one hand and on the other hand, right? And that's kind of like the answer to your question, which I'm going to give. I mean, the answer to the economists will say is, of course we can do that. And, you know, the basic tenets of economics are that humans are rational, that they respond to incentives, and they operate under constraints. And so take greenhouse gas emissions for the moment. We use the atmosphere as a dumping ground for greenhouse gas emissions. Now, every time you breathe out, you're putting CO2 into the atmosphere, right? So that by itself is a contribution to the concentrations in the atmosphere. It doesn't really make too much difference from an individual perspective, but if you take what agriculture does, broadly defined, agriculture accounts for roughly a third of total emissions. That does matter, right? So we need to find a way to give all of the people involved in agriculture incentives, because they're all human beings. They all operate more or less rationally, sometimes less and sometimes more, but more or less rationally. We need to give them incentives, which can be negative or positive, right, to reduce what they're doing. So that's the answer is yes, we can do it, but the answer, the no part of that is we seem to have real trouble actually implementing those kinds of policies. Cap and trade went nowhere fast in the U.S., and a tax on carbon probably isn't going to happen anytime soon. So the alternative is to, an alternative, not the best alternative by any means, is to invest in new technologies that both reduce emissions and are profitable in and of themselves. So examples might be, nitrogen fertilizer that is encapsulated so that you increase nitrogen use efficiency, or cropping systems that increase yields while also putting more carbon into the soil. You've got to find ways. If we can't do the right thing, which is from an economist's perspective, put a tax on or put a physical limit, then you have to do these second or third best things.
What do you see as the biggest barrier for agricultural response and reduction of greenhouse gas emissions? Why is it so hard in ag to get the ag sector actually organized around this?
Well, there's a couple of different answers. I would have a couple of different answers to that question. First one is that, you know, does anybody know how many coal-fired power plants there are in the United States? No. It's about 1,000, I think. So, you know, somebody at each one of those and monitor them for very little cost and figure out what's going on. How many farmers are there in the world, right? You know, how many million farmers are there in the world? Very difficult to do that. So that's one of the reasons why it would be technically difficult to, you know, monitor agricultural emissions, individual agricultural emissions. It's the same thing as another way to say this is agriculture is a non-point source of greenhouse gas emissions, and those are obviously harder to handle than point sources. So that's one of the reasons. And the other one is that, frankly, the the research on greenhouse gas emissions and climate change came to agriculture very late. The potted history is that the climate science guy said, you know, we understand from physics that when the sun comes down and bounces around the CO2 atoms, that you capture some of it in the form of heat. That's the early part of the last century. And then somebody said, well, maybe we should actually figure out how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere, and then how it's changing over time. And somebody said, oh, look at that, it's going up, right? So then the question is, where is it coming from? Well, the first obvious place that you'd think to look is fossil fuels, right? Cars and coal. So that's the first and second assessments of the IPCC. And then the environmentalists got involved because they were unhappy about us cutting down trees and harming the environment generally, and said, we've got to stop cutting down trees. So they came up with this concept of avoided deforestation and got behind the climate change push as much for the environmental concerns as for the greenhouse gas and emissions concerns. And you know, the history of the environmental movement with respect to agriculture has not been good. It's only in the last few years that there has been somewhat of a meeting of the mind, understanding that, you know, we are going to have to eat. We can figure out how to do this more environmentally sensibly. And the agriculturalists realizing, you know, that there are sustainability issues that you've got to deal with. And so... it's taken about four assessments of the IPCC in 20 years before the realization that you could do something about agriculture, but also the numbers on how important agriculture was. Until they put together the inventory of greenhouse gas emissions from different sectors, nobody had a clue, right? I mean, the obvious things are greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels and then cutting down trees. Measuring methane is hard, measuring nitrous oxide emissions is hard, and adding those all up is even harder. So it's a relatively recent, like two or three, 4 year phenomenon, that the recognition of how serious agricultural greenhouse gas emissions is has become available.
But measuring soil carbon is not so hard.
Measuring soil carbon is not so hard, but it's expensive. And soil carbon, typically, classic soil carbon is volatile, right? So you plow the dang soil and up it goes in the air. I kind of have become a bit of an advocate of, but not too strong, of biochar, which doesn't volatilize doesn't decompose. And so I think, Cornell, I believe, is doing a fair amount of research on biochar.
He participated in
the Yes. So I think, you know, there's some interesting things that could potentially be done with biochar. Yeah, well, the private sector will do quite well, thank you, on crops that they have a mechanism by which they can capture return on their investments. You know, the large seed companies spend $1 billion, $1.5 billion a year on research, and they are very focused on dealing with climate change. And I think we'll address, although my understanding is that there's issues with dealing with heat tolerance that are a lot harder than dealing with drought tolerance. So that's still a challenge. I mean, there are fundamental biological constraints in plants that they're having trouble with. But it's the open pollinated varieties, or the varieties that have relatively small markets in poor places, where we really desperately need to reverse the trends on expenditures on public sector agricultural research. So again, just to throw out some numbers, the budget of some, I will leave it unnamed for the moment, large biotech companies, $1.5 billion a year to work on 2.5 crops, right? So what's, anybody know what the budget is for the CGIAR, which works on, I don't know, 15 or 20 mandate crops and covers the rest of the world? A slight exaggeration, because Embrapa's out there and CAS in China's out there and the Indian Ag Research Program is out there. But anybody know what the CG spends? What's the CG budget a year?
Tell us.
$700, $800 million now, for all the rest of the crops in all the rest of the world. So the research expenditures by the public sector. Now, we should not forget, of course, that ARS does some work on these varieties and these crops, right? And so do the land-grant institutions in the U.S. and the research institutions in other parts of the world. But, you know, the bucks that we spend on those other crops are small relative to what we spend on the crops that the private sector does. And the trend in the 20th century was all down. And it was all down because that was the trend on prices in the 20th century. But as I'll show in the report, it's a little advertisement for sticking around until 4 o'clock. Until 4 o'clock, prices that we see going in the future are going the opposite direction. Substantial increases in prices between now and 2050. And while we were initially kind of the early people talking about these price increases, in fact, other groups that are doing modelers are now talking about substantial price increases as well. So food security and then the climate change threats on top of that are a huge challenge for the 21st century. And so, you know, we need to figure out, that's another reason for the Global Futures Project. We need to, you know, it was not unlimited dollars. Anybody who's been near the federal government recently knows about that. And we need to figure out how to use that money really efficiently.
One thing I think we always need to bear in mind when we're thinking about agriculture and some fundamentals of how one improves yields is that you may be using different techniques in different parts of the world. I mean, a fundamental issue about agriculture is...
You can't hear the question back
here. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Just saying that the fundamentals of agriculture really are crop production is genotype times environment times management. How those three factors interact, I think, is really what really controls levels of yield and quality. And I think we don't want to always go down the route of saying we can just breed our way out of this. Because I think in certain areas of the world, you could get a huge amount of improvement in yield by simply having better management. I mean, for instance, in Africa, if one doubled the amount of nitrogen farmers put on fields, you would have an enormous effect on it.
Right. No, I totally agree.
Frankly, the breeders are not going to get anywhere near that in the short term. And we have a short-term problem.
And that's partly a failure of the economists, actually, who... I mean, this is fundamentally a policy issue, not a biology issue. I mean, there's biology questions. But you know, why is it the farmers in Africa are not using more fertilizer? And the answer is because the roads to get to the farms, from the farms to the market centers, are crap, and they're not getting any better. That's perhaps changing. And the governments put on policies that cause those prices for fertilizer to be artificially increased and the price of crops to be artificially depressed. And so that's what we as economists need to do. And, yeah, I don't expect the breeders to solve all of our problems.
There was one comment in the back. Let's take that. That's the last comment. And then Jim will come up and tell about model under comparison.
So I may be repeating it, but I really don't quite understand why... don't somehow encourage or make funds available for the poorest people in the world, and I work a lot in sub-Saharan Africa, the Sahel, to replace some of the soil carbon they've lost as they mine the soil of carbon and nitrogen for food production. It should both increase yield, support food security, and sequester some carbon. Why is there no incentive?
Well, so the one question is, why are there no incentives to increase soil carbon in poor parts of the Africa where you've got degraded soils? And you might actually ask the question, well, why is it that farmers themselves don't do it if, in fact, it would increase their productivity of their crops? And the answer is the short run versus long run problem. Yeah, you've got this immediate need to feed your animals, so you take the fodder off to do that. But it's also the case that under the UNFCCC, there's discussions about reducing emissions by paying farmers to, in fact, find ways to incorporate ways to increase their soil carbon. And frankly, there's a lot of controversy about that, and misplaced in my view, controversy about that. There's some legitimate questions about measurement and how easy it is to measure, and there's concerns about sustainability, how long will the stuff stay in the ground, right? But then there's also concerns that's the classic, oh, you know, the rich countries are going to buy their way out of their obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by spending money on poor farmers in Africa. Well, I say, more power to them, you know. If it's cheap to do in Africa, we're killing at least two birds with one stone. We're getting the carbon in the soil, and we're getting more income to those poor farmers. So I don't see the problem with that, but anyway.
Great. Jerry, thank you so much
glad
for leaping into the breach here.